Coming up in this episode.
He was a lovely man, but he looked like something out of another century. I said to him, you know, are there any careers that you think, that I would think, are not boring, that would use my maths degree? And he thought for a moment and then said, no, I don't believe there are. And he was genuinely trying to be helpful. You know, he wasn't trying to be unhelpful.
The Logistics Collective podcast is a series focused on the logistics industry, where there are many incredible stories to be told. We'll be speaking with those who've worked and are working within the industry today. What have been their experiences, good and bad, since joining? And would they recommend a career in the industry to others? Here's your host, Malcolm Pope.
Hello and welcome to our next edition of Logistics Collective, the podcast. Today, I have the pleasure in interviewing another true legend of the logistics and supply chain industry. From her early career as management trainee for DHL XL Logistics, moving through a distribution design manager role for TNT, a consultancy career at PE, and then into a 12-year stint as logistics controller for Marks & Spencer, providing internal consultancy across multiple geographies. Our interview also played a significant part in the establishment of the foundations for e-commerce for grocery for Tesco. She then established her own consultancy, Arisia, over 20 years ago, and has been providing knowledge and clarity from data for a wealth of blue chip clients, and is and will always be my go-to point for counsel on how not to drown in data. To my life raft in the stormy oceans of data, I'm happy to introduce a superb woman in logistics, Kirsten Tisdale. Welcome to you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Malcolm. Good to talk with you.
It's good to talk to you as ever. We've known each other for a while now.
We have.
Hopefully we're a fine vintage, but let's see how we can get on. So I'm going to start with a question for you. What was your dream job as a child?
Definitely sort of mechanic rather than princess.
Okay.
I'm not sure I actually knew what the word mechanic meant, but that's where my sort of, my heart never lay with being a princess.
Fair enough. Didn't with me either. I'd make an appalling princess, certainly with my figure anyway. So tell us a little bit more about what you do now.
So I'm a consultant. My entire career has been in logistics, and I've got a maths degree. So I enjoy projects which are anything to do with looking for the stories and patterns in data, using maps, graphs, etc., to explain to clients what I'm seeing. I enjoy looking to the future by creating models of operations where you can change parameters and see what impact different metrics have within an operation.
Okay. In terms of working in logistics and supply chain, what does it mean to you?
I always wanted to have a what I would call a meaningful job, Malcolm. So I'm not a particularly frivolous person, although I like having a good time. But I wanted a job where I felt I was contributing. So I did think strongly about manufacturing, but ended up in logistics, and logistics firmly fills that bill for me.
Fantastic. So what's your best time of day to do any work then?
Oh, well, my best ideas I have in the middle of the night, which is unfortunate. So I have to scribble them down on a post-it note in the dark. But my best time for actually getting things done is first thing in the morning. I'm quite an early bird.
So you're an insomniac innovator that gets up early.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I have all my best ideas in the afternoon and late evening. And I'm...
unsociable.
I'm very unsociable. And I guess in the morning I'm like an old car on full choke. But there we go. That's me. So what's been your best career experience so far?
My best career experience, my most interesting career experience, was working at Newsflow, which was quite near the beginning of my career, but where we were two things. I joined the organisation as the second employee after the MD, Doug Carlton, and that was Newsflow was within the auspices of National Freight, as it was then, DHL now. And we moved we did two things. We launched the London Daily News, which was a rival to the Standard at the time, and that meant scheduling 17,500 drops over 24 hours. And then also moving the Mirror, Sunday Mirror and People from rail to road, which sounds like the wrong way round now, but at the time it was the right thing to do. Newsfast had moved the Sun and the Times off the rail. The critical mass of volume had gone. Rail anyway was hugely inflexible for newspapers, for something where the news might change halfway through the night. You might have a mechanical breakdown. True just-in-time manufacturing. And and then the unions, I'm somebody that's quite pro-union. I've managed operations in closed shop environment, and that's been fine.
Me too.
But the print unions they'd just taken over the operation entirely. I had never actually visited an operation before and seen people sleeping with newspapers over the top of their faces. That is how overmanned it was. And yes, so
wow.
There we go.
I guess different times. No pun intended. So thinking about the best career experience, is there a worst career experience you'd dare to share?
I would say that Newsflow was both the best and the worst, to be honest. It was like World War III at times. Not everything went to plan. The MD went off with heart problems on day two of the Mirror going onto the road. If I've learned a lesson from that, Malcolm, it would be trust your own judgment, because I didn't feel that we had fully planned things, and we hadn't. And yeah.
Is a great answer. I mean, what were your key learnings coming out of that then, that sort of yin and yang of printed media experience you've had?
Well, as I say, certainly to trust your own judgment. And another interesting early career experience was the very first job that I had when I stopped being a trainee. So my first full management role, where I was in charge of the finances of the operation. And I discovered that there had been, I'm going to call it internal fraud. No money actually left the company, but the figures were being presented as much better than they should have been. And as a result of somebody effectively bullying somebody to declare better figures than was actually the case. And again, quite an interesting early learning in terms of you've got to be very careful what incentives you give people, how you incentivize people, because if you're not careful, you can push things in the wrong direction.
I absolutely agree. And I can share experiences less on the financial side, but certainly more in terms of KPIs that were being used to present business internally, and a degree of, shall we say, it wasn't really gilding a lily, because I think it was, you know, more about silver spray painting a weed, really, but in essence, wanting to get less heat as a result of presenting better KPIs. And my simple explanation back as to the reason why I felt that was fundamentally wrong is that these KPIs are essential to run your business. And if you lie to yourself, you're effectively lying to your organization, and you're actually stopping the necessary improvement and progress to be made. Other side of it, though, I guess it's if every time that you went to go and see, shall we say, the upper echelons to present, whether it be your KPIs or financial results, and you had to have a few exercise books in the back of your pants because you were going to get a really bad response, that may well make it understandable. So it's interesting how behaviours connect, isn't it? So thinking back, I get the maths degree, and I think that's the purest form of science possible. I'm more of a words enthusiast, as I found out, in spite of having a scientific background. I've found in later life I'm more about words. I like the purity of thought around mathematics. But your sort of segue into logistics and supply chain, when did you first see it? I mean, it's not an obvious choice. And without wishing to be anything other than hugely respectful, it wasn't at that time probably a first choice for many women going into logistics and supply chain.
I hadn't even heard of logistics and supply chain. I'm one of those people that totally...
I hadn't when I started. It was called planning.
So I completely fell into it. I left university. All my colleagues were going into roles in auditing and accountancy, and I really couldn't see myself doing something like that. And I went to see the careers advisor at the Imperial College, the university I went to, and asked the senior lecturer who was in charge of careers. And I just need to paint a picture here, Malcolm. He was the only lecturer that still wore a black gown to give his lectures. And he looked like something out of, he was a lovely man, but he looked like something out of another century. And I said, you know, are there any careers in auditing, accountancy? Or the other thing was to stay in academia. That was the other thing that people were doing. And so I said to him, you know, are there any careers that you think that I would think are not boring that would use my maths degree? And he thought for a moment and then said, no, I don't believe there are. And he was genuinely trying to be helpful. You know, he wasn't trying to be unhelpful. So anyway, I spent a couple of years doing non-career jobs, and then there was a jobs fair at Imperial College, which is where I'd ended up working in a non-career position. And I went along to this jobs fair to see some manufacturers, to see some other companies, and National Freight just happened to be there. And I went to see them, and I had an interview at the time, a first interview, and then was invited for a second interview. But if they hadn't been at that jobs fair, I wouldn't be sitting here now. I had no idea logistics and supply chain existed.
So on that basis, what surprised you most about it when you started? I mean, you know, that must, it's a steep learning curve for sure, you know, no inkling and then right in the middle of actually one of the largest businesses in the UK at the time.
I've always found it a really interesting career, a really interesting business to be involved with, because there's this need for, there's a need for planning and then for pragmatism. There's a need for being able to deal with people. Yeah.
What do you wish you would have known when you started your logistics career that you know now?
So probably not so much when I started my career, but I sort of lost my way a little bit partway through my career. So I thoroughly enjoyed being at the sharp end. I thoroughly enjoyed making money for my company. And indeed, that's one of the things when I was looking for a career start, I was looking for a company with a good management training scheme and where I'd have early responsibility for profit and loss. I like counting money. I think that's what it is. And through a combination of flattery and having a large mortgage at the time, I ended up taking a role that was in a cost center rather than at the money-making end of the business, and which the role that I was doing, although it was described as logistics controller, that was my sort of technical position. It was a project-based role, which I really enjoyed on a day-to-day basis, but I wasn't part of the sort of the core role of the department. And so, I as I say, I sort of lost my way a little bit. And so what I'd say in terms of a lesson learned there is to be true to yourself and make sure that you're always keeping your objective in mind, because it's easy to be flattered out of your sort of true direction.
I can sense the steel beneath the velvet glove, without a shadow of a doubt, within here. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, being hugely cognizant of what you're there to achieve is really key in everything that you really do. What's motivating you right now?
I think what's motivating many people in the sort of wider logistics area is the cost of living crisis, and with that, the cost of doing business crisis, which is, you know, those two things are going along side by side. And the need for companies to be able to cover all their costs but make a profit at the same time, but not make their services and goods so expensive that no one can afford them. And I think that's a very difficult balance at the moment for companies.
And certainly a lot of what you published on LinkedIn is trying to illuminate that and perhaps illuminate the root causes and get people to think a little bit. I mean, your sort of connectivity with so many different data sources and bringing them together and bringing conclusions out of that. I mean, that's your legendary factor from my perspective, amongst other things like fascination with really interesting classic cars, but we'll come to Tartres later. But the essence of you, why did you start Arisia? What was the drive behind it? And did it go the way you expected?
Very good questions. So I enjoyed the spell of consultancy that I'd done with PE, which was comparatively short, but I really enjoyed that. And my thoughts have been for a long time to return to consultancy. I had a year off when I was at Marks & Spencer, so sort of like a gap year from work. And I got back from that gap year and got to day two and went, I have to do something. I have to do something different. I don't want to carry on, you know, being here. So I, being me, I didn't sort of, I got all my ducks in a row. I set my company up. I got my website. My boss at Marks & Spencer, Garth Thorne, knew what I was doing. So I didn't have to be particularly secretive about it. And he was somebody who, if he was in on something like that, he could be really supportive. And then I got to, I talked to various people I might do projects for. And then one day Garth came in, it was a Monday morning, and he came in and it was quite early and sat at my desk and said to me, what are your plans, Kirsten? Do you know? Because we have plans in the department and we really need your employee number, as they used to be sort of called. We need your employee number for something else. But he said, there is genuinely absolutely no pressure. If you want to carry on staying here, that's great. But if you are going to decide to go, we could do with knowing about it. So I rang my husband up. I said, I'm handing my notice in today. And I handed my notice in. It did me good, because it was one of these things where it could have gone on forever, if you know what I mean, planning to do it.
You took that leap of faith.
Then immediately, as you can probably imagine, all the people that have promised me projects, they sort of like evaporated. And it was actually quite some time before I got my first project. And it was from somebody who I had worked at Marks & Spencer and was now working for another company. And then that sort of kicked things off. And yeah, things have been great ever since.
And so if you were to put in a nutshell, what does Arisia do? Could you do that?
What does Arisia do? Arisia, it helps companies by helping them to plan into the future. So some of the projects I've been involved with are looking sort of 10, 30, even 50 years into the future. What resources will you need? Helping people to understand the geography of their business in terms of, maps, hotspots of customers. Where's the best place to have your depot? Where's the best place to, what areas are you going to service from there? And as I said before, sort of finding the stories in data is probably the patterns. That's what really sort of interests me.
So coming to that view of, future logistics, I mean, could you give us some sagely views of what you think is going to change in the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years? What do you think the keys are?
I think there's some interesting dynamics happening right now in terms of not just the sort of inflationary aspects, which we've already talked about, but in terms of people's attitudes to China, political attitudes to China. It will be a very big move for the West to go away from China in terms of a manufacturing base. You only have to look at container rates from China to, Europe or the US, and then container rates going in the opposite direction to see where the balance of volume is. Then obviously we've got net zero, we've got sustainability. In carbon terms, can we actually keep the planet as somewhere where we can all live? What I hope is that we move to I'd actually like to see logistics get smaller, Malcolm, which probably is goes in the opposite direction to some other people. I would like to see a less consumer-oriented society, and not because people are forced to be less consumerist, consume less, but because they want to consume less. So it's very interesting seeing things like, you know, when Princess Diana wore a dress, the same dress for a second occasion, it was sort of shock horror. She's wearing the same dress as she wore to something else. Whereas now you can watch Dragon's Den the other night and see Sara Davies saying, I'm wearing a dress that five other people have worn before I got it. And I think that's really encouraging.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think the focus back on local, I absolutely do agree with you. I don't think we can. I mean, the economic advantage of manufacturing in China, there's going to be an argument really here that says, once you offshore something, do you lose the skill base in order to be able to bring it back? So that's one argument. And so you've got a living memory to address it with, if you're going to address it at all. But if we look at the political world or the world of conflict, it does seem that there is a potential for China to become perhaps a less popular sourcing point going forward for the future. Sustainability might indicate that for some things we should be looking more about onshoring again, and certainly in terms of looking that you mean in terms of looking at sustainability and, you know, reuse, recycle, upcycle, and do all of this, I think is fascinating. You know, there's a lot within that. I mean, for me, it fascinates me that we've looked at e-commerce as being something that is driven by big brands. And in my head, I look at it and say, well, what about a small town of, let's say, a lot of independent retailers in there? Why haven't they got themselves set up with an online version of themselves collaboratively and actually deliver stuff that, well, you could go see it if you want to, which is part of the joy, but if you don't necessarily want to drag it all the way back home with you, well, there's local bus services or taxi services, arguably, that could be used to deliver it. So I think there's tons of stuff that can be done that's absolutely fascinating. And I think we could level things up. But, you know, we're tending to think in straight lines. I like you because you're a friendly siren turning around and saying, well, okay, we're beginning to see the change in things. And I think that's a really important role to play in the industry. So, is there anything that surprised you in logistics and supply chain recently? Is there anything that in the last year or so has been standout for you?
What's interested me a great deal is the market elasticity, actually seeing that in action in terms of as resources have become short, prices have gone up, as goods have become short, prices have gone up. And that sort of thing, I guess, we all knew happened, but I don't think until recently I've seen that happen in such an extreme way. And yeah, I think it's been interesting rather than surprising.
I think me looking at it has been the lack of inertia on price increase has fascinated me. And I think it's almost like a swarm behavior. I mean, it sort of drives that everybody determines. We all almost talk ourselves into saying that things therefore must be more expensive. I think we've got to go and look at our commodity traders and hedge funds and all of that to say, well, okay, it's interesting. I mean, your raison d'etre is obviously to make profit and to maximize that profit. And it has a place. One might argue or consider, is it too much of a place at the moment? Or you might argue it's not enough a place at the moment. But nevertheless, it probably amplifies some of the key trends that are going on at this point in time. It is sort of interesting, having been, you know, in my lifetime, we've seen conflict rather than outright war. And I'm looking at this at the moment saying it looks a little bit scarier than any conflict that we've seen in the past. So perhaps understandable we get volatility. I guess it's how do we respond to it. It's interesting. I don't know the answer.
We know.
So what's the biggest problem you've solved last year thinking about Aricia, if you can tell us?
If I can tell you, yeah. Well, that's an interesting start point because one of the, if I have a general problem with Aricia, it's that a lot of the projects that I do are confidential because they are either, they're affecting people's jobs, they're affecting property, they're affecting, they could affect share price, you know. And therefore, that makes it quite difficult sometimes to promote the company to the extent that I actually have a colleague in the industry who believes I work for MI5 because I'll never talk about what I do. And that's a problem. So if I have a problem, it's promotion. And that's not just been in the last year. That's been probably an ongoing problem.
Well, I'm yet to see you sitting in a park with wearing a park pink carnation and a folded newspaper next to you and maybe a Homburg hat and an overcoat, you know. With the best one in the world, I do know people that have actually worked in that environment obliquely. And I don't know, there's a place to that. But can't say their names for fear of well, getting told off. Simple as that. I'm coming to the inspiration question now. And I've been really fortunate in my career that I've had a number of people that have inspired me. I'm reasonably fulsome and clear in terms of who's inspired me, and I hope that they know. And I want to say to you, you're one of my inspirations in the career, because I always remember you worked with me. And were incredibly supportive and gave clarity in terms of the work that you did. And I thought, I'd never really understood how to make data beautiful, how to actually put it together so that you've got clarity. And you know, I do remember still, and I know that we didn't give you anywhere near enough business in terms of there, but hey ho, you don't always work for inspiring people. But I think the work that you did there was phenomenal. So you're my inspiration. So in terms of that, now that I've thoroughly embarrassed you, has anybody inspired you? And I don't need you to give back.
If this is a difficult question, and I'm not going to give it a straight answer, Malcolm, because I don't want to offend anybody in the industry. I've worked for multiple bosses.
Fair enough.
I'm going to talk about somebody who was my very, very first boss, who I had a Saturday job at Exmouth Town Library and reshelving books. So that's probably my first job in supply chain, reshelving books. But he reminds me now of Foyle in Foyle's War, to the extent that actually I can't actually remember what the chief librarian was like. But what I do remember was what he was like in terms of the things that he did. He was very, very good with people. He, if children came to the library for the first time, he would absolutely make sure that they enjoyed themselves, so that he was setting himself up with sort of future customers for life for the library. He, there was a tramp who used to come and sleep in the library, who was always referred to as Mr. So-and-so, and treated with the deepest respect. And it was understood that when he was sleeping in the library, no one was to disturb him, not us, not the public. We had a member of staff who was, we're talking back in the 70s here now, we had a member of staff who was a transvestite, which it was an extremely brave way of presenting yourself in a publicly facing organisation in the 1970s.
Certainly was.
And again, he's so good at dealing with people. And then he could also be amusing dealing with people as well, because we had a little car park out the back which wasn't supposed to be used by anybody, but you know, you could get away with parking there if you were actually coming into the library, but periodically people would park there and then go into town. And when that happened, he would go and lock the gates of the library and then tell people, tell us that if, when that whoever it was came in, we were to say that he'd gone to the betting shop for the afternoon and we had no idea when he'd be back. There's that sort of combination of enthusiasm, of care with respect to people, and but also having a certain, you know, a good sense of humour at the same time. I've certainly, in terms of dealing with people, he was very inspiring.
And they're important in our career, these points of inspiration. So I think it's a lovely balance you describe. Let me show over the breadth of your career now. And if you are looking at what do you think is the biggest fundamental change between when you started to where you are today?
That's an easy one. Computers and the internet. When I started in the industry, when I was at university, the computer for the university took up the whole of the floor of a building, and you used to have punch cards and then deliver the punched cards, and your stuff would be allocated a time slot at some point in the future when it suited other people, and you would wait for the results. When I started in logistics, all the scheduling was done by hand. When I talked to you about news flow and the 17,500 drops in 24 hours, we didn't have a computer to do that. And then when I moved to places like TNT and PE, you would leave computers running overnight. You know, as things progressed, now you could schedule, but you would leaving things running overnight, hoping you got the settings right so that when you came in the morning, you could, you know, you would have a useful result. Now, even the longest thing, you go and make a cup of coffee, and by the time you come back, it's finished. So that has just changed entirely. And with respect to the internet, access to information, you know, you used to have to squirrel away all sorts of information when you came across it. If you went to an exhibition and there was some sort of brochure that had some statistics in it, you'd save it and, you know, reports and things like that. Now, you know, you can just go and find that information on the web, if you know where to look, which is brilliant.
It's a really good answer. And probably our generation has been the generation that's lived through this digitalization process. We remember the foundations of it in terms of what principles were automated, which I think is going to be relatively unique, as it'll be something that we lose as time goes on. But hey ho. What occupation other than your own would you have liked to try, or would like to try, you know?
I was going to say there's one I'd still like to try, and that is that I would like to become a non-exec director of a company at some point. It's not something that I'm talking about lightly, because I've actually done some training in the past on the role of director, non-sort of finances for non-financial directors, the role of women as directors. So if you're out there and you want a non-exec director, I'm just putting it out there to everyone. I would be interested.
Well, that's a strong recommendation from me anyway. I think that is the sort of counsel that businesses do need. And you have my 100% support in terms of that and recommendation. I'm going to have one securities question, which is Tatra. Now, myself and Kirsten have a slight common interest, but across different brands as far as classic cars concerned. And for those that don't understand what Tatra is, it's a Czechoslovakian-based car, I think, and rear-engined, but far more sophisticated than, all right, what was the wonderful Skodas, etc. at the time. But how did you get interested in them?
So my husband had been interested in Tatra since he was about 8 years old, after somehow discovering about them. And that was just something that was sort of out there, if you like. I then had, when I was at Marks & Spencer, I had a young Czech businessman attached to me in our department, in the logistics department, for a day. When I went for lunch and said to him, oh, you know, my husband's interested in Tatras, he'd like to meet you. And Yeah, and went, well, why would he be interested in Tatras? And we made great friends with him. Jan went back to the Czech Republic and was trying to find a T-87, which is one of the ones with the big fin down the back for my husband. But in the meantime, found a much more modern Tatra, because Tatra made cars all the way from, the late 1800s through to the late 1900s. So for over 100 years, they made cars. Anyway, so he found one of the more modern cars, and we went over and bought that with the objective between the sort of the two parties, Jan and ourselves, of selling it to make some money. We never made some money on it, but because we had it, we then got into who else owned Tatras in the UK and set up the club for them in this country, which has now become effectively the internationally English speaking club. We don't pay, we don't charge people to join it anymore. We have a newsletter, which I do about once every 6 weeks, mainly talking about what events we've got and who's got parts for sale and, you know, things that people want and need and what have you. And at the moment we have three other classic cars. We've got a Tatra 603, which we're currently selling. If anybody wants to buy it, it's on auction on Car and Classic coming up in March, because we have bought, and we do things in the wrong order, Malcolm. So heart before head sometimes. We have bought a Honda 1300 coupe, which has an air-cooled engine in the front. And we also have a Mercedes 130, which is a rear-engined water-cooled car. So, and that's our oldest car from 1934.
Wow.
Yeah. And I've missed out. And we have a T97, which is the smaller baby with a fin down the back, which is a flat four air cooled. So, yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. You see, we never know about people. I'd known you for years, and I didn't know about this until... It was a conversation whereby I think I was going to a classic car show somewhere and we began to talk things through. So look, in the last few minutes of the interview, I'd like to focus on maybe perhaps giving some advice to people considering a career in logistics. So do you think it's a good idea for people to consider the logistics and supply chain industry as a top three career choice? And if so, why?
I think there's such a wide variety of roles in logistics that there is literally something for everybody. There's, you know, we talked before, there's roles that require planning, there's roles that require pragmatism, there's roles that require dealing with people, there's roles that require innovation. And I did a presentation a while back to Westminster University MSc students. And I actually had a slide there which had a whole series of words, attributes, and then the sorts of jobs in logistics that required those attributes. So I think whatever you're like, there's a role for you in logistics, and you can then grow into all sorts of other areas. Once you're here, come and join us.
And it's a friendly family to be part of, for sure.
It is.
What advice would you give to somebody that's just starting out and maybe is interested in a logistics career? How might they find out more about it?
I think marketing ourselves as a sector is something that we plainly have been no good at in the past. We, we have shortages. We seem to have this difficulty attracting people to us. If you're at school, if you're at university, go on a visit to a warehouse. Amazon, you can just sign up on the web for visiting some of their locations, or you might persuade your school careers people to do a visit to a DC, or you know, write to the manager of the local warehouse that you see on your way to school, and try to persuade to let you to come and visit. If you're already decided to go into logistics, I would definitely recommend spending some time at the operational end of the business, working at the sharp end, being that person that's carrying out a delivery, being that warehouse supervisor that's having to make decisions in the middle of the night, because whatever you then go on to do elsewhere in logistics, it will give you a really good understanding of the sorts of reasons why some things work, some things don't work, and will give you credibility that you'll never get if you don't have that operational basis.
Really sound advice. And of course, there are the normal career prospectus from the institutions like Chartered Institute of Logistics or any of the other Logistics UK or any of the other organisations out there could perhaps give a little bit of background in support of that. Kirsten, I want to say thank you. Thank you for giving up your time to do this. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk. Logistics Collective has got plans to carry out a whole number of podcasts over the coming year. And if you want to understand more about the Logistics Collective and all of the other interviews that we've done, please visit either our website, which is logisticscollective.com, or we're available on the majority of podcast channels, including Spotify and Apple and a lot of others. So in parting, Kirsten, thank you again.
Thank you, Malcolm.
You can get in contact by email, podcast@logisticscollective.com, or leave a voice message on our website, logisticscollective.com. The podcast is a production by LoGuru.